The Federal News Update for Monday, January 5, 2026. Welcome to the Deep Dive, the only place where we take the fire hose of federal activity and filter it down to pure, actionable insight. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide, and I'm ready to dissect what has been a monumental last 36 hours.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. And you're right, this isn't just a busy news cycle. What we're seeing in the documents, the EOs, the legal filings, it points to a systemic overhaul of the U.S. government's operational doctrine.
Exactly. Our reporting period is exhaustive. You know, it covers 000 hours, January 4, 2026, right through noon today, January 5th. And when you look at it strategically, it's not just a bunch of random actions. You see two massive, aggressive policy fronts just converging.
That is the crucial takeaway for you, the listener, right now. The two defining features of this period are, one, this high-intensity foreign interventionism, specifically Operation Absolute Resolve.
Right.
And that's running in parallel with equally aggressive radical domestic restructuring.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the rapid implementation of the DOGE mandate and the formal renaming of the U.S. military's entire command structure.
And the single immediate point of friction, the crucible where these two massive forces meet, is the Constitution itself. The Venezuela extraction has immediately escalated the confrontation over the War Powers Resolution of 1973.
Yes.
The administration executed a military operation that looks, feels, and smells like an act of war, but they are vehemently claiming it wasn't.
And this is the core strategic debate we have to break down. The executive branch is deliberately blurring the lines. The jurisdictional lines between military action, which we usually call Title 10,
mm-hmm.
and intelligence ops, that's Title 50, and domestic law enforcement, which is Title 18.
So our job here is to connect those dots between the White House doctrine that justifies this, the battlefield tactics, the severe economic sanctions, and then this systematic dismantling of key domestic agencies. It's all one story.
It's all one story of a new, highly executive-led governmental posture.
Okay, let's start right there at the very top. The executive branch and this incredibly novel doctrine, the what of the foreign intervention is clear. A unilateral U.S. military extraction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Cilia Flores, from Caracas, that happened early January 3rd. But what's their custody status right now?
Right. So as of 12 p.m. Eastern today, January 5th, Maduro is firmly in the custody of the Department of Justice. The DOJ. Oh,
and what's his immediate schedule?
He is set for arraignment in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, the SDNY, at noon today. This arraignment is, well, it's historic. It's the first time a sitting or recently extracted head of state has been brought to the U.S. to face criminal charges since, I think, Manuel Noriega in 1989.
The Noriega precedent helps frame it, but the legal framework here feels far more aggressive. What is the specific legal justification, the why, for using military Force 150 aircraft no less against a sovereign nation while denying it was a war?
The administration's entire legal architecture rests on two pillars. First, the criminal enterprise theory, and second, this new model of trusteeship.
Trusteeship.
Yes. The president asserted on January 4th that the U.S. would, and I'm quoting here, run the country of Venezuela until a transition could be secured. This means they are not recognizing any existing political opposition or a government in exile.
Run the country. I mean, that is an astonishing, really unprecedented claim in modern U.S. foreign policy. How do they legally justify stripping a nation of its sovereignty to that degree without declaring war?
They argue that the Maduro regime was never a sovereign government in the traditional sense.
Not a state, but something else entirely.
Exactly. They've legally defined it as a criminal enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the Cartel de los Soles, or the Cartel of the Suns. By framing the regime as a foreign terrorist organization and a drug cartel, the framework legally nullifies sovereign immunity for Maduro.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, the administration is treating the entire government of Venezuela as a Title 18 law enforcement target, a criminal defendant. And the operation, despite using Delta Force and bombers, was framed as just executing an arrest warrant.
That's it. An arrest warrant based on the 2020 narco-terrorism indictment. They're arguing this is not a Title 10 act of war against a sovereign state.
It's a stunning legal maneuver. I mean, it attempts to bypass the War Powers Resolution completely.
Precisely. The rationale is that you don't need congressional authorization to arrest a known criminal defendant, even if that defendant happens to be surrounded by the trappings of a state.
Okay, let's unpack the practical side of this running the country trusteeship. Secretary of State Marco Rubio clarified the strategy. It's not a permanent occupation, but an economic chokehold. What are the specific mechanisms?
Secretary Rubio laid out two immediate, highly coercive actions. First, enforcing a strict oil quarantine. Second, using captured assets, so seize financial holdings, physical property, to rebuild the Venezuelan economy. The U.S. is effectively acting as the nation's financial receiver.
And what's the leverage to force compliance?
Rubio's language was deliberate. He said the objective is to use the incredible, crippling leverage of U.S. sanctions and naval blockades. The sanctions are designed to seize control of their primary revenue stream, oil, and then use that control to force a fundamental, rapid restructuring of the Venezuelan state.
It's financial receivership, backed by military might.
That's the model.
We also have to talk about the logistics of the presidential command structure here. It's been highly unusual. Where is the president located right now?
The president remains at his private residence, Mar-a-Lago, in Palm Beach, Florida. It's currently serving as a temporary command center for monitoring the global fallout from Absolute Resolve. He held a joint press conference there with Secretary Rubio, the new Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
And on the diplomatic front, there's a staggering detail about a trip being considered, one that shifts the focus dramatically.
This is one of the most explosive, least reported details of the weekend. There are internal discussions happening right now about a potential and highly controversial presidential trip to Ukraine.
To Ukraine. Why?
The purpose would be to address the Ukrainian parliament directly, specifically about a very sensitive proposal involving land concessions to Russia.
Wait, land concessions? That's not a negotiation. That's effectively demanding an end to the war by formalizing Russian territorial gains. It would overturn years of Western policy.
Absolutely. The proposed maneuver is explicitly aimed at finding a framework to unilaterally end the war in Eastern Europe. It signals a willingness to engage in really contentious, high-stakes diplomacy immediately after a high-stakes military intervention. It shows the administration is operating on two massive geopolitical fronts simultaneously.
That is a staggering sign of aggressive self-confidence. Okay, let's pivot now from this intense foreign intervention to the radical domestic restructuring that's happening at the same time, because the same velocity is being applied at home. We need to talk about the Department of Government Efficiency Duo GE.
Right, moving directly from White House doctrine to the operational dismantling of the domestic bureaucracy. The Duo GE mandate is being driven by the U.S. DOGE Service Temporary Organization.
And what are the specific legal origins and timeline for this temporary organization?
It was established via Executive Order 14158 back on January 20, 2025. It's mandated to operate until July 4, 2026, with the goal of dismantling what the administration calls bureaucratic inefficiencies. And we're seeing that mandate executed with extreme prejudice right now.
And the first major visible and deeply controversial consequence has been what they're calling workforce optimization at FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Can you give us the details on the terminations?
The reports are clear. Significant termination notices went out to FEMA personnel, specifically targeting the cadre of on-call response and recovery staff, the core staff.
And these terminations were effective when?
January 2, 2026.
For the listener who doesn't track FEMA staffing, who are the core staff, these aren't just desk workers, are they?
No, not at all. These are the backbone of rapid disaster deployment. Highly trained, specialized experts. We're talking engineers, environmental specialists, logistics coordinators who are trained for on-call response and recovery. They're the essential reserve that FEMA relies on after a major hurricane or an earthquake.
And what are agency insiders calling this mass layoff?
Internally, within FEMA and across DHS, this is already being called the New Year's Eve massacre. It eliminated a critical class of specialized employees right as the high-risk weather season is starting to ramp up.
So what's the operational impact? What are former officials saying about the strategic risk?
The warnings are dire. Former FEMA officials are on the record saying the agency, quote, cannot do disaster response without this core staff. This action immediately elevates the strategic risk for the U.S. homeland. And you have these concurrent challenges, more severe weather, and the massive logistical demands of securing the upcoming 2026 FIFA World Cup.
Is there specific regional data showing where these cuts are hitting hardest?
Yes, and the granularity here is important. The cuts in FEMA Region 10, that's Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska, have been described as deep and disabling.
Disabling.
Intelligence suggests these cuts have left that region unable to simultaneously respond to multiple disasters. So if they face, say, a major flood and an earthquake at the same time, the capability to handle compounding crises has been drastically compromised, all for short-term budgetary efficiency.
This detail provides a crucial narrative thread, this efficiency versus resilience trade-off, We're seeing radical efficiency drives at home, the DOGE dismantling, while simultaneously investing in overwhelming lethal offense abroad with the DRW. That domestic risk profile is massive.
It is the central irony of this new doctrine. Aggressive military action abroad really requires robust homeland resilience to guard against asymmetric retaliation, yet that very resilience is being systematically targeted for cost savings.
Let's shift now to the regulatory side of DOGE. The White House is pushing a massive overhaul through an executive order titled Unleashing Prosperity Through Deregulation. Can you walk us through the plumbing of this effort?
The core mechanism is the very ambitious 10-for-1 mandate. For every new regulation issued by any federal agency, that agency has to identify and eliminate 10 existing regulations.
10-for-1, that places an immediate, almost impossible burden on agencies.
It does. And then there are the financial constraints. There's a highly technical numerical cap attached to this order for the current fiscal year.
What's the specific language on that cost reduction?
This is the critical technical nuance. The order mandates specific cost caps. For fiscal year 2025, the total incremental cost of all new regulations, and that includes the calculated savings from the 10 repealed rules, must be, and I'm quoting the EO, significantly less than zero.
Significantly less than zero. I mean, that essentially prohibits agencies from adding any net cost and demands a massive net reduction in financial burden, effective immediately. What does that do to due process?
The immediate impact is speed and, you know, potential circumvention. To meet a mandate of significantly less than zero in one fiscal year, agencies have to repeal costly rules of velocity. This almost guarantees they'll use emergency waivers to bypass standard procedures like notice and comment periods just to hit the mandated savings. It further erodes oversight.
And outside of DOGE, what other key executive orders or actions have we seen in the last 48 hours?
Two crucial administrative actions. First, on compensation, the president issued an order adjusting rates of pay for the executive schedule, effective January 1st. This is essential for setting pay for leaders across the newly restructured departments.
And the second?
A major policy signal on the judicial front. The Supreme Court is preparing to hear arguments on a presidential executive order that directly challenges birthright citizenship. This is setting up a massive legal confrontation with the 14th Amendment.
We've covered the administrative and doctrinal side. Let's move to the most highly visible structural change. The transition from the Department of Defense to the Department of War, the DOW. Give us the full scope of this transformation.
This transformation is now complete. The operational finalization is tied to Executive Order 14347, titled Restoring the United States Department of War, which was signed back on September 5, 2025. As of January 2026, the transition is fully solidified across all signage, official correspondence, and, crucially, legal authority.
What is the official rationale for reverting to this, well, this historical and aggressive terminology?
The EO states the name change is intended to signal our strength and resolve to the world and share peace through strength. It directly references terminology used during World War I and World War II, trying to evoke an era of military decisiveness.
And who are the confirmed leaders under this new offensive-minded structure?
The new leadership titles are confirmed and in place. You have Pete Hegseth as the Secretary of War. Steve Feinberg is the Deputy Secretary of War, and General Dan Kane from the Air Force is the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And Secretary Hegseth has been very vocal about the accompanying cultural shift this name change represents.
He's framed this as a mandate correction. Hegseth publicly stated that the department hasn't won a war since World War II and that the new name reflects a necessary shift to an offensive footing. His stated goal is clear. We're going to go on offense, not just on defense. The name is meant to align the department's focus with maximum lethality and decisive victory.
Okay, let's use Operation Absolute Resolve as the debut proof of concept for this new DOW doctrine. We need maximum tactical detail on how they executed this extraction. What was the exact timeline?
The mission was rapid and precise. It commenced late on January 2nd, and the target Maduro and Flores was secured and extracted in the early morning of January 3rd. This is a highly targeted, time-sensitive mission to remove them from a fortified military fortress in Caracas.
What was the force composition, the boots on the ground?
It was a classic joint special operations mission. The ground teams were elite U.S. special operations forces, specifically elements from Army Delta Force and Navy SEALs. They were supported by aviation from the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, the SOR, also known as the Night Stalkers.
And the air assets, you mentioned 150 aircraft. How massive was that supporting air operation?
It was a substantial show of force designed for overwhelming dominance. Over 150 aircraft were used, a mix of fighter jets, heavy bombers, sophisticated drones. These were deployed for what's called SEAD, suppression of enemy air defenses, and to provide critical close air support for the extraction teams on the ground in Caracas.
And we heard a detail about weather impacting the timeline.
It did. The president noted that unseasonably poor weather had delayed the operation by a full 4 days. Commanders had to monitor a rolling window for conditions to be stable enough to ensure the safety of such a complex mission. It highlights the tight margin of error.
Let's talk casualties. Given the scope of the operation, what were the costs for both sides?
Crucially, U.S. forces reported zero casualties, which just underscores the successful integration of intelligence, air support, and special ops precision.
And on the Venezuelan side?
Estimates suggest 80 or more forces were killed during the coordinated air and ground strikes on naval assets and during the breach of the fortress where Maduro was located.
Zero U.S. losses on an intervention of this scale speaks volumes, but none of this happens without critical intelligence. What was the specific role of the CIA?
The CIA's role was absolutely critical. A covert CIA team had been operating in Venezuela since August of 2025. That's 5 months of on-the-ground intelligence gathering.
And these weren't standard diplomats.
No. Critically, these officers were operating without diplomatic cover because the embassy was closed. It made their operations far higher risk. Their intelligence was essential for the military to pinpoint the target's exact location.
And moving from kinetic operations to future capability, the DOW is also driving aggressive technological modernization. What are the key initiatives coming out of DOW research and engineering?
The DOW is focused on building what they call an AI-first enterprise. The first major initiative is the launch of GenAI Mill, a new generative AI platform designed to embed artificial intelligence into daily operations for all 3 million personnel. A massive IT overhaul.
And the second area focuses on hardware, pivoting away from expensive legacy systems.
Yes. The DOW is aggressively pushing drone dominance. They recently hosted a drone petting zoo at the Pentagon to showcase American-made prototypes developed within an incredibly rapid 12 to 24-month time frame. It's a strategic shift toward rapid, attritable, autonomous systems.
Finally, what are the new critical technology areas, or CTAs, that have been prioritized? The specifics here.
Six new priority areas were released, but two specific ones reflect the DOW's focus on preparing for high-end, near-peer conflict. Contested logistics and scaled directed energy.
Contested logistics and scaled directed energy.
Right. Contested logistics suggests major investments in protecting supply lines in denied environments. Scaled directed energy signals a focus on developing high power, non-kinetic weapon systems.
We also need to touch on personnel readiness. Is the National Guard currently mobilized?
Yes. The Louisiana National Guard remains partially activated. Up to 350 members are under Title 32 status, federally funded, but under state control. That activation runs through February 28th. This is likely supporting ongoing domestic operations.
Okay, we've covered the kinetic and structural changes. Let's transition to the apparatus of economic and diplomatic warfare, the State Department and the Treasury. Let's return to Secretary Rubio and the absolute necessity of maintaining this precise semantic distinction, the not a war narrative.
The semantic distinction is the entire defense strategy for the State Department. Rubio delivered it repeatedly on Sunday talk shows, stating explicitly, "There's not a war. We are at war against drug trafficking organizations."
Why is framing it that way against a non-state actor, a drug cartel, so existentially crucial for their constitutional defense?
It is the single defense against the War Powers Resolution claims. By defining the adversary as the Cartel de los Soles FTO, the State Department argues they circumvent the constitutional requirement for congressional approval. They claim the indictment of Maduro as a narco-terrorist strips him of sovereign immunity, meaning the military extraction wasn't an act of war, but a highly militarized law enforcement operation.
So let's nail down the operational mechanism for this oil quarantine. It's not a traditional naval blockade. How does the U.S. legally enforce it?
It's enforced as a criminal seizure. The mechanism is predicated on finding probable cause that the oil is proceeds of crime.
Proceeds of crime.
Yes. So if a vessel is identified as carrying sanctioned Venezuelan oil, the U.S. government seeks a court warrant, a Title 18 law enforcement warrant, to seize the vessel. The legal rationale is that the vessel and its cargo are tainted assets from the Cartel de los Soles criminal enterprise.
That requires complex coordination. Which three entities have to work together to execute that?
It's a perfect example of the hybrid doctrine in action. The goal is to paralyze the regime's revenue. This requires close coordination between the Treasury Department, which defines the sanctions, the Department of War, which handles the naval interdiction, and the Department of Justice, which obtains the court warrants to legalize the seizure.
Regardless of the legal framing, this action has triggered significant international fallout. What's the immediate reaction from the global community?
Immediate, intense friction. Colombia requested an emergency UN Security Council meeting, which is scheduled for today, January 5th. Their primary concern is regional instability. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, expressed being deeply alarmed by the raid, citing potential breaches of the UN Charter on sovereignty.
And we are seeing street-level reaction in Europe. Where are the anti-US protests happening?
The US mission to Italy issued demonstration alerts for January 4th and 5th. Protests are organizing in major Italian cities. In Florence, specifically in Piazza Ognissanti, and in Naples near the U.S. Consulate General.
Yet, amidst all this, the U.S. is still engaging with elements of the regime they just deposed. What's the diplomatic channel for short-term stability?
Secretary Rubio confirmed the U.S. is engaging with Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez regarding short-term stability. Rubio acknowledged that practical necessities require working with existing power structures to prevent total anarchy and a security vacuum.
Let's move to the Treasury Department and the maximum pressure campaign enforced by OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. What specific actions were taken to close the net on the regime's oil finances?
OFAC was extremely aggressive right before the extraction. On December 31, 2025, OFAC sanctioned four companies and identified four specific oil tankers as blocked property.
What was the strategic significance of targeting those specific vessels?
They were identified as part of the regime's shadow fleet, which uses deceptive shipping practices to evade sanctions. This action is critical because it closes the loophole on Venezuela's ability to export oil to non-aligned nations like China or India.
And beyond the state-run infrastructure, Treasury is targeting individuals in Maduro's inner circle. Who specifically?
OFAC has leveled sanctions against the immediate family members of Cilia Flores, Maduro's wife, specifically targeting her nephews. They're alleged to be key nodes in the regime's money laundering operations.
We also have a specific designation targeting the proliferation of defense technology, confirming the Iran-Venezuela nexus.
Right. New designations were issued on December 30th, specifically targeting the proliferation of Iranian UAVs drones to Venezuela. Treasury identified 10 individuals and entities involved in this trade.
Before we move to DOJ, any routine domestic administrative functions within the financial sector?
Business as usual for the trade regulators. The Department of Commerce initiated administrative reviews of various anti-dumping and countervailing duty orders effective today. And today is the deadline for public comments on a new Postal Service agreement at the Postal Regulatory Commission.
The contrast is just incredible. Okay, let's move now to the Department of Justice, which is now handling the legal fallout of this historic extraction. We need to focus on the granularity of the prosecution of Nicolas Maduro.
The DOJ is bracing for an unprecedented legal challenge. The defendants are Nicolas Maduro and Cilia Flores. They're set to face charges from the 2020 superseding indictment.
Let's detail the charges specifically using the exact legal terminology.
There are four core charges. One, narco-terrorism conspiracy. Two, conspiracy to import cocaine into the United States. Three, possession of machine guns and destructive devices. And four, conspiracy to possess machine guns and destructive devices.
And all of these are predicated on the idea that he's not a head of state.
Correct. They are all predicated on the idea that Maduro's true identity is the leader of a violent, drug-running criminal enterprise.
What's the venue for this legal proceeding, and where is Maduro physically being detained?
The venue is the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, the SDNY, in Manhattan. Maduro is currently being held at the Maximum Security Metropolitan Detention Center, MDC, in Brooklyn. The security protocols there will be extraordinary.
And the ultimate legal strategy hinges on stripping him of head of state immunity.
Correct. The DOJ is relying on the theory that Maduro's status as a narco-terrorist strips him of that immunity under both international and U.S. federal law. This isn't just a high-profile case. It's a foundation-challenging legal argument that will almost certainly reach the Supreme Court very quickly.
Moving to domestic security, what counterterrorism and extremism plots did the DOJ disrupt just before January 5th?
DOJ unsealed charges on January 2nd against a North Carolina man for attempting to provide material support to ISIS. The chilling detail is that the suspect allegedly planned to use knives and hammers to carry out attacks on New Year's Eve.
And what about non-Islamist threats, anti-government cells?
Yes, the threat matrix is diversifying. Four defendants were arrested for an alleged plot to bomb U.S. companies. The DOJ classified this cell as driven by anti-capitalist and anti-government extremism. And a Texas man was charged on December 29th with providing bomb components and funding to individuals he believed were members of a foreign terrorist organization.
That sets the stage for the Department of Homeland Security. Let's start with the immediate consequences of the DOGE cuts on FEMA resilience, tying back to the New Year's Eve massacre.
The capability gap created by the DOG-mandated cuts is severe. The termination of the Corps employees on January 2nd has fundamentally altered the agency's risk profile. Their removal means longer response times and greater coordination failure risks during complex disasters.
And you mentioned the disproportionate impact in the Pacific Northwest.
Specifically, FEMA Region 10, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Alaska, is now internally rated as severely degraded. Reports suggest the region can no longer simultaneously respond to multiple large-scale disasters. The administrative efficiency drive has directly created an operational resilience deficit.
Yet FEMA is still executing high-priority security missions. What are the specifics of the World Cup security funding?
Despite the staffing crisis, FEMA awarded $250 million on December 30th. This massive grant is specifically for Counter-Unmanned Aircraft Systems, CUAS, to secure the airspace for the upcoming FIFA World Cup 2026. It shows a distinct prioritization of high-profile, kinetic threats over long-term disaster response stability.
Moving to IC and CBP under DHS, the administration is aggressively expanding the 287G program. Can you detail that increase?
The 287G program, which deputizes local and state law enforcement for federal immigration enforcement, has increased by a staggering 609% under this administration. Recent opt-ins include Bexar County and Balcones Heights in Texas, showing a massive push to use local resources for federal enforcement.
And DHS Secretary Kristi Noem has been very clear about the policy regarding temporary protected status, TPS, for Venezuelans, especially now.
Yes. On January 4th, Secretary Noem defended terminating TPS for Venezuelans. She stated that with Maduro removed, Venezuelans could go home to a country that they love. This statement signals an imminent aggressive push for mass repatriation.
We also have major manpower recruitment data from ICE.
ICE reported a remarkable 120% increase in manpower after a massive recruitment campaign brought in 12,000 new officers. This surge facilitated high-tempo operations over the holiday, explicitly targeting what ICE calls the worst of the worst, criminal aliens.
Okay, we've established the executive branch is operating at peak aggressive capacity. Now we must transition to the legislative branch, which is where the constitutional crisis over the war powers dispute is about to explode.
The 119th Congress is returning to session, facing an immediate existential conflict over the separation of powers. And the primary friction point is the war powers dispute from Operation Absolute Resolve.
The technical detail we need to nail down is the Gang of Eight notification failure. What's the standard protocol and how is it broken?
Protocol dictates that the Gang of Eight top congressional leaders and intelligence committee chairs must be notified of major covert or military operations. The breach was clear. The administration did not notify these leaders until after Operation Absolute Resolve was fully underway and Maduro was already extracted.
A significant deviation from norms.
A significant deviation and a direct challenge to congressional oversight.
What was the immediate reaction from congressional Democrats?
It was fierce. Senator Chris Murphy accused the administration of outright lying during December briefings, where officials had explicitly claimed operations were strictly counter-narcotics and not preparation for regime change. The Democratic leadership views this as deliberate deception to sidestep their oversight.
Let's track the partisan alignment here. What is the Democratic leadership doing to check the executive branch?
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has called for a floor vote on a war powers resolution this week. The objective is to block further unauthorized military action. And Representative James McGovern called the extraction attack unjustified.
And how are key Republicans defending the executive's action?
The Republican defense is built entirely on the administration's legal theory. Senator Tom Cotton argued forcefully that the War Powers Resolution does not apply to law enforcement extractions of indicted terrorists, reinforcing that Title 18 framing.
I see.
Senator John Thune, while supportive of the outcome, has specifically requested further, detailed briefings to understand the long-term plan.
Let's nail down the legislative calendar for today, January 5th. What is the Senate doing this afternoon?
The Senate reconvenes for a regular session at 3:00 p.m. today. But the critical business is the confirmation vote scheduled for later.
And who is that vote for, and when?
At 5:30 p.m. today, the Senate will hold a confirmation vote on Keith Bass to be Assistant Secretary of War. This vote is highly significant. It's the first major litmus test of legislative support for a nominee in the newly renamed Department of War right after this operation. A positive vote signals a strong endorsement of the DOW's new posture.
What about the House of Representatives?
The House adjourned its first session signed eye on January 3rd and immediately convened the second session. They have no votes scheduled for today.
And one key personnel shift to note.
Yes. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's resignation becomes effective tonight at 11:59 p.m. This triggers a special election in Georgia's 14th district, temporarily altering the partisan balance in the chamber.
Finally, let's turn to the judicial branch and the Supreme Court, which is also returning to session today. What immediate administrative actions are expected?
The Supreme Court returns from winter recess today. The immediate action is the issuance of an orders list at about 9:30 this morning. This list details which cases the court has decided to grant or deny. It's important to note no opinions are expected to be released today.
Any specific administrative stays or extensions granted recently?
Yes. Justice Alito recently granted an extension for filing in the corporate securities case of Johnson & Johnson v. San Diego County Employees Retirement Association. The deadline for filing has been extended until February 4, 2026.
Looking ahead, the docket is heavy with culturally and politically significant cases. What are the key upcoming oral arguments we should be tracking?
The first major argument is Little v. Hecox, set for January 13th. This case challenges Idaho's Fairness in Women's Sports Act and will likely determine the legal standard for transgender participation in sports nationwide. The ACLU tried to moot the case, but the court kept it, signaling its importance.
And the other major case is the birthright citizenship challenge.
Correct. Arguments will be heard this term on the presidential executive order challenging birthright citizenship. This is a direct test of the 14th Amendment's subject to the jurisdiction thereof clause, a foundational constitutional question.
We've tracked these massive federal movements, but what about the day-to-day functions of the lower federal courts that intersect with all this?
They continue to process the administrative state. Commerce's new anti-dumping reviews mean the Court of International Trade will be busy. And the deadline for comments on the Postal Service Agreement highlights the constant administrative work required by the Article I and Article II courts.
As we synthesize this monumental 36-hour period, let's return to the core tension you outlined at the very beginning, this law enforcement war hybrid.
What's so fascinating here is how the administration weaponized legal definitions to justify overwhelming military force. They have successfully blurred the lines between Title 10, traditional military action, and Title 18, criminal law enforcement.
By framing an invasion as serving a warrant.
Essentially, yes. By framing the military operation in Venezuela as merely executing a Title 18 arrest warrant for the Cartel de los Soles, they are attempting to strip Congress of its war powers authority.
What precedent does this set globally? This feels like a foundational shift.
The implication is massive and potentially terrifying. It sets a precedent where U.S. military force can be used against sovereign heads of state without congressional approval as long as that leader is under a U.S. indictment. This opens the door to lawfare retaliations. We have to consider the risk of adversaries, China, Russia, Iran, retaliating by issuing their own indictments against U.S. officials or allies to justify their own extraterritorial actions, citing the Maduro capture as precedent.
We also have that incredible contrast at home. The efficiency drive of DOGE versus the aggressive offensive doctrine of the DOW. Let's reanalyze that efficiency versus resilience trade-off.
The administration is prioritizing lethal offense abroad while simultaneously dismantling domestic resilience capabilities. The successful extraction of Maduro, the DOW's offense, is juxtaposed against the gutting of FEMA's operational response capability through the DOGE cuts, specifically that New Year's Eve massacre of core staff.
So we have a clear risk factor. Short-term fiscal savings creating a long-term vulnerability.
Exactly. The short-term savings from the FEMA cuts create a long-term resilience deficit. This makes the U.S. homeland uniquely vulnerable to asymmetric retaliation, say, a massive cyber attack or a biological threat. That would require the exact domestic coordination mechanisms that are being dismantled. The Department of War name change emphasizes lethality over domestic support. It tells you where the focus really lies.
To bring all these threads together for you, the listener, The capture of Maduro, the renaming of the military, the radical regulatory cuts, the legal warfare against sovereign immunity, and the intense constitutional clash over war powers. These are all components of a single, unified, and radical shift in the structure and doctrine of the U.S. federal government. It is a decisive move toward a highly centralized, aggressively executive-led policy that fundamentally redefines the balance of powers.
And the Senate War Powers Resolution vote scheduled for this week is the critical political and constitutional test of that redefinition.
Indeed. And here is the final provocative thought for you to mull over as you process these extraordinary developments. Can Congress effectively check executive war-making capability when the executive has successfully achieved a popular result? The removal of an indicted adversary by simply labeling military action as criminal law enforcement. What happens if Congress attempts to defund a success? Consider the profound implications for the balance of powers when public opinion is leveraged so effectively against constitutional oversight.